Greetings, dear, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Working Experience, a very warm, open-arm audio embrace and a squeeze. This episode is brought to you by my company, One Circle Media. One Circle Media is a hybrid digital agency and media content creator. We create and design apps, websites, videos, social media content, and physical products. We are artists, directors, designers, producers, coders, editors, thinkers, makers, and creators who embrace story and creativity from design, web and app development, animation, docs, features, TV shows, digital and social media content to physical products. For our clients, we create content that builds networks and audiences across multiple platforms. Check out our work at onecircledigital.com and onecirclebrand.com. If you work for a network, studio, brand, startup, or corporation and are looking for a partner to create media that will build, engage, and entertain, reach out to me at john@onecirclemedia.com. I'd love to hear from you. This episode is also brought to you by an app that I created called Still Believe. Still Believe transforms a picture in your home into video proof of your child's favorite magical characters. With the app, parents can catch the magic of the Tooth Fairy, leaving money under their children's pillow, or Santa delivering presents on Christmas Eve in their home. You download the app, take a picture, and we create the magic. We utilize feature film visual effects artists to transform your picture into video. Just tell your kids that you have a special app that can detect and capture the Tooth Fairy, then present them with the video proof in the morning. The look on their faces is priceless. Your Still Believe video is created in minutes, and you can then save it to your phone and share it on social media. The app is available for the iPhone and Android, and it's free to download. Our aim is to bring joy and wonder into the hearts of children around the world. Check it out at stillbelieve.co. Thanks, everyone, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Working Experience.
The Working Experience.
Route 93 North is almost at a standstill. It's a rough one out there this morning. Snow and sleet.
There is no service on
the... Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Yeah, folks. We're going to be a few minutes. We have train traffic ahead of us. We should be moving shortly.
John, we need that report ASAP.
Where are we on that presentation?
Dan, HR wants to see you.
Did you return that email yet?
We have a team meeting at 10.
To stay late, Bob.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
They're moving in a different direction.
And after the meeting, we'll have a breakout session.
Who ate my
Where are my hot pockets?
This microwave is disgusting.
Oh, God, what's that
He was rubbing his
Sexual
toenails at his desk.
I
can't take it anymore.
Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Working Experience Podcast. It's Matty Kay.
And John, howdy, folks. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Working Experience. We are filled with gratitude that you are listening to us.
Filled with gratitude. However, by almost...
But, there's always a but.
By almost every major statistical measurement, the average American is worse off than they were a generation ago. Go. Discuss.
Oh, wait a minute. And we have a pill for that.
Yeah.
If you
if you
buy our t-shirt or our pill box for $99.99, which is actually a deal, it comes out to less than a buck a pill.
I mean, we barely make any money off of it.
Bitch. Razor thin margins. Razor thin.
Yeah. I mean, especially with all the lawyers we have to pay.
All the, yeah, the lawsuits.
Oh, jeez.
The FDA is on our ass constantly.
The IRS. It's just unbelievable how, I mean, you know, you fudge a few numbers and all of a sudden you're a criminal. I mean, a criminal.
Yeah. You make some statements that some people claim are false.
I said may cure.
Yeah.
May, right? That's always your get out of jail free card, isn't it?
You may fly, so there is the possibility that you won't fly, but you could fly.
It will cause explosive diarrhea. We're very upfront about that. Will cause.
Yes.
Not may cause.
Right.
It will cause.
That's one of our definitive statements.
That's a given. That's an absolute given. So people are, you hear this mantra all the time, and we are right in the middle of an election cycle. how many Democrats are in the field right now? About 55, 60 people running for president.
Bloomberg is joining. It feels like I also read an article that Hillary Clinton is contemplating jumping into the ring.
Oh, God, no. Jesus Christ.
Yes.
Lady, you know, she's becoming like you have to stab her in the heart with a silver stake to get her to die politically. I voted for Hillary Clinton and I would vote for her again, but holy Jesus. I read where she was asked that and she pretty definitively said no. I think even she. But Deval Patrick jumped in to the race. He was the former governor of Massachusetts.
Yes.
Before Mitt Romney. So we have Elizabeth Warren and Deval Patrick. Let me say, aside from John F. Kennedy, Massachusetts has not had a great track record with presidential candidates. We had, England really in general.
I don't think, honestly, anyone in the field stands a chance against Trump right now.
I would dispute that, but... Not wholeheartedly. I mean, yeah, he's... I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Now, you don't get out of the thinking of the coasts, like the East Coast and the West Coast. Does anyone...
I am a liberal elitist. That I was born that way. I'm going to die that way. That's all I can tell you.
I don't know. Does anyone hold a candle to him in middle America? Not... Nobody.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there are some cracks in the armor. You know, this impeachment thing hasn't helped. Although, as you say, I don't know how much.
It's the really only thing that could derail a second term for Trump would be if the economy nosedived, like severely, if we dipped into a recession.
Well, but, you know, like he made a lot of promises with the coal mines that never came to fruition. There's a lot of I don't know if you can just say it doesn't matter. I mean, if you're talking about the economy, then a lot of people took a huge hit on their taxes. You know, they didn't get the refunds they were expecting. And I don't know.
Yeah, but look what good Elizabeth Warren is proposing in terms of taxing.
Well, yeah. I mean, we didn't get into this to have a political debate. We were sort of, well, I guess this does dovetail nicely with the American dream. I mean, I suppose it's... I've always found, without getting into the finer points, that Americans, like many people, are very hypocritical when it comes to money. They want a government handout, whether it's called a bailout or a subsidy or welfare or whatever you want to call it. They want a bailout when they're in trouble, when their particular industry, banking, the auto industry, cattle ranchers in Montana during a drought, they were looking for federal relief. So it's not called socialism then, and it's not called taxation. It's, well, the government should help us out. When it's someone else getting help, like an inner city person, a person of color, a person who's not from this country originally, then it's welfare, socialism, tax cheat, blah, blah, blah. So,
no, that's human nature 101.
Yeah, well, I mean, sure, but it's still hypocritical. I mean... Well, this kid was criticizing communism, socialism in one of my classes. And I was like, look around you. And he sort of looks like, what? Like, we're in a public school. Like, what do you think this is?
The fire department, the police department.
Yes, yeah. I think one place tried libertarianism, some small country, and it just collapsed. Like, it doesn't work. So, you know. I don't know. But yes, things Elizabeth Warren is proposing seem somewhat radical, but so did the New Deal. You know, so did the Great Society. So is Medicare, Medicaid. I mean, that stuff's just standard. Social Security. I mean, when that was proposed, those were seen as very radical ideas, and socialism, and FDR was painted as a socialist, and all of that. But try taking away Medicare now. I mean, you wouldn't get a vote from anyone over the age of 60.
No way. Yeah, no way. No way, no how. So, well, there's certain things that they're political untouchables, and that would be like Medicare and Medicaid. Though Republicans want to pull it back, but to a certain point, the military-industrial complex, like, that's the one thing that I don't get. It's like, okay, we got to raise taxes for all these programs. It's like, no. Why don't we take a look at what we have currently and see if we can make do? And look at the biggest expenditures and say, hey, can we cut back on maybe some tanks or F-35 fighters or whatever the new gadget is that we need for a non-existent war?
Because that employs so many people and it spreads so much. Like, you try closing a military base in someone's state. Oh, my God.
Oof.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally obsolete. You know, these the weapons they manufacture today are not really, they're not for World War II era. I mean, I don't mean the technology, but, you know, we fight different types of wars now. Where an aircraft carrier for $6 billion doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but it employs a lot of people.
No, it's economic war. It's technology right. war. I mean, yeah. it's a different set, and we are still, you know, throwing money in case like Russia attacks us or China attacks us. It's just insane.
They do attack us.
They do.
They're not sending 500,000 troops to land in California. Neither is Japan. They're going to attack us economically. But
right.
Or
on Facebook, or they're going to try to disrupt our elections.
Right. But if you're the congressperson or you're the senator from a certain state or district and it employs 10,000 people to build these aircraft
untouchable.
Carriers, yeah. I mean, you know, it's like, okay, so it doesn't really matter. And a lot of this is just Trump's ego, too. I mean, he loves building big stuff that's outrageously expensive and basically useless. Look at his hotels and casinos. And he considers that an achievement. And there's a lot of people who feel that way. They love military parades. I've never been a parade person. I don't understand the point of a parade. I don't understand going to a parade. My dad was big on them. And he used to drag us to them until we were about 14. And then after that, I was just like, no, I'm not going to this anymore. I'm done. But like, remember Trump wanted to have tanks rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue?
It was going to be like $50 million or something. It was some ridiculous amount of money.
And it was like, they just logistically couldn't do it. And also, it was going to pull all these people in on their long weekend during like Memorial Day, cops, firefighters, all these different people. And it was just going to make everyone miserable. So this guy could be like Kim Jong-un and watch his tanks roll by like a kid.
Well, I read that Trump's inclination to play golf has cost the American taxpayers $100 million.
Really? $100 million? Even I wouldn't have said that.
$100 million, yeah. Because if you think about it, when he plays golf, you have Secret Service has to fly down. They have to secure the entire location. They have to secure a golf course, right? So that's the surrounding area. That's air too, right? So if someone tried to take out Trump, and a lot of these things cost hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. So if Trump is played, let's just say a typical golf outing for Trump costs $500,000 with Secret Service. That's all his salaries, benefits, hotel rooms. You know, say the Secret Service contingent is like 20 or 30 deep. I think that's probably about right, about $500,000. He plays golf 20 times. Not 20 times, 200 times, $100 million.
Yeah, and you're right. People in the Midwest who are making, I don't know, $15 an hour would still think he's their hero.
Absolutely.
I don't understand absolutely. It. Yeah.
Well, you know what? Let's not get too deep into the weeds in the political discussion. Let's talk about the... It does tie in.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this is politics. The idea that... we just read in my classes, and I've read them a number of times now, Death of a Salesman and Fences, which are very much about, and The Great Gatsby, very much about the American dream. We were looking at novels. Yeah. Two of them are plays, just to clarify that. And The Great Gatsby's a novel. So sorry, everybody, about John's lack of knowledge about literature.
Yeah, I'm butchering up my intelligence.
Well, you read them over Twitter, I think. Is that right?
I like to keep everything on cliff notey. Under 140 characters.
Exactly. So we were looking over different things. One, the title of an article caught my eye, or caught John's eye. The American Dream is Killing Us, and that's basically like what those plays are about. Like with Willie Loman, he kills himself at the end of the play because he's worth more dead than alive because of his insurance. And it's not a very happy view.
Yeah, and it's the, you know, it's the constant state of competition, and it's the idea that it's the American ideal of anyone can make it, and if you can't make it, you're a failure.
And it's your fault.
I see it in, you know, everyday life in my community and work is. People are judged by their social status, but, you know, how much money they make, their job, et cetera, et cetera. And if you make a lot of money, ergo, you're a good person, which, you know, when you're young, it's a very idealized way to look at things. And as you get older and you meet multiple people, you quickly realize that that is not the case. But society almost celebritizes, lack of a better word, people like the Kardashians. Like they make a lot of money. Like there's no doubt about it. The what was it? Chris? Who's the mom? The manager? Is it Chris?
Oh, gee. My extensive knowledge of the Kardashians. Yeah, I guess. Well,
whoever the mom is.
Dial it back for a second. Their father was a very prominent attorney in Beverly Hills and very famously was friends with O.J. Simpson. I think he helped out with his defense team. I don't know if he was actually on the Dream Team.
I think he was involved.
He was definitely involved personally with O.J. Simpson because they were friends. But, yeah, and I guess he was on his legal team in some capacity. But my point being, like, the family has been able to basically capitalize on his success, much like Paris Hilton has been able to capitalize on success that was already there. So they're not exactly self-made people.
No, they're not self-made, but the mom took it to another level.
With like, celebrity, they, as you say.
Yeah, they capitalized on their name, but essentially they do nothing. Like they do nothing and they're worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
They advertise their lives. They're the product.
Right, it's reality TV.
Yeah. There's a band called Exodus, which are this old thrash band. They've been around since the 80s. And the guy, one of the guitarists, lead guitarist, all the time wears a T-shirt that says, "Kill the Kardashians." And then one of them responded to it. And they got into this, like, Twitter war over it, something like that. And the guy was like, look, I don't mean literally kill the families. Like, I don't even know them. But he's just sort of, the whole concept is ridiculous. As you were saying, they don't do anything. And they're just sort of, you know, these very...
Well, what's dangerous is the message that sends to, you know, young people and society in general is that, you know, anyone can do what... You can do nothing and become famous and rich and... And not only that, be lauded for it. Like, you're, you know, the best of the best. And then all of a sudden, they're giving advice to the masses. And that's where things just take a nosedive.
Well, I think there's definitely, and I would have to say the Kardashian, I mean, I don't know them personally. Let me just disclose to our audience, I don't know the Kardashians personally.
I do. I'm on a first. Yeah. I know them personally.
There is a large amount, I think, of derision geared towards them. Like people, I mean, I think people know this. You know, they know what they are. You know, maybe not a 15-year-old, but, and I think there's a certain sort of defensive quality about them sometimes, where they're like, they know they don't produce anything. They know they don't do anything. They're just kind of ridiculous. And we've always had people like that. When you say the media somewhat celebritizes rich people, I think not somewhat. They absolutely do. I mean, rich people are you know, like they get famous for being rich. I mean, Bill Gates, and I mean, he's produced things. Mark Zuckerberg, you know, I mean, Facebook's not wonderful, but he's produced something. But they are a phenomenon. Yeah, they don't do anything. And I think there is a certain amount of disdain for that, but there's also a certain amount of admiration, just for or envy, I might say, for having all that money. So,
and you're automatically assumed to be a good person. Like before, you know, the truth came out about Jeffrey Epstein, this guy was, you know, lauded. He was giving, you know, tens of millions of dollars to research institutions like MIT, Harvard. He was good friends with Bill Gates. He was, you know, this very successful, you know, billionaire businessman. And then, you know, the truths reveal that he's running this underage sex ring for his own pleasure.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess if you just, like, I have no idea what Bill Gates knew or didn't know. Certainly he's not been implicated in anything. But, you know, if you just know Jeffrey Epstein from seeing him at fundraisers, you know, it's sort of like, well, why would you know anything about him? Now, he was then convicted. And then, I mean, there were people who still had associations with him. Actually, one of the people at MIT lost his job for accepting donations from Jeffrey Epstein after he'd been convicted the first time. Ooh.
And he, what about Bill Clinton? Bill Clinton rode on his private jet 27 times.
Yeah. You know, that's, yeah.
You think old Billy knew something?
Yeah. You know, it's like, I don't, and Clinton's never had anything with underage women, but he certainly had his difficulties with that, shall we say. well, maybe he didn't view them as difficulties. I don't know, but they nearly caused him to lose the presidency. Certainly after he was convicted the first time, you would say like, oh man, I don't, you know. I don't know. It does raise interesting questions. It's like, if he's donating tens of millions of dollars for valuable research, cancer, whatever he was donating to, should that money be turned away? Should it be put to good use? I mean, like Mother Teresa was always accused of accepting money from drug dealers and really terrible people. And it was like, well, I need the money to run the
Well,
the
it's
hospice.
Right. Does the ends justify the means? It's a very good social and moral question.
Now, I would say no. I mean, I would say you can't have underage girls being abused, or any women for that matter, but particularly underage girls. And justify, I mean, that is just, I mean, it'd be one thing if he was,
but let's say, you know, as a thought experiment, that MIT had no knowledge of this, and accepting money.
Right, yeah. No, do you give it back? No. I mean, I think.
No, you don't give it back.
No. You know, the guy who accepted the money after he had been convicted claimed he didn't know where the money was coming from. This and that. I mean, you cannot accept money from a convicted pedophile. That's just not, I don't care. Because you're trading on someone else's misery, and you just can't, to me, you can't do that. And Jeffrey Epstein's not doing it out of any sense of altruism. He's doing it basically to buy friends, I think, you know, allies.
No, and to buy friends, powerful friends, so that he can get sweetheart deals when they eventually reveal that he's a, you know, a sex trafficking pedophile.
Yeah, and you noticed how, well, who is it? Prince Andrew, is that his name?
Yeah, Prince Andrew, yeah.
He just resigned his position, stepped back from his royal duties, whatever it is, because apparently he was very heavily involved with Jeffrey Epstein, and, you know, it's just like...
Yeah, there were some photos that popped up.
Ooh, that's not good. You know, it's like, you guys... I just cannot understand these guys who would, like, actually treat a 15-year-old girl that way, who would actually do that. You know, like, you see how scared this girl is, you see how much this pains her, and you do it anyway. Like, that is one of the most effed up things I can imagine. Especially when you look at these people, and they're very respectable and powerful, and they have wonderful suits. Like, Man,
you're ruining someone's life.
Christ.
Like, you know, you're destroying them mentally and physically.
And spiritually and every other way you could possibly think about. All right. Well, before we get too deep into that, it is a tawdry side of the American dream. Like, it's sort of like if you reach a certain level of society, you can kind of do whatever you want. And because you have so much money, it's not going to touch you. Now, fortunately, that Jeffrey Epstein got grabbed and his money couldn't protect him anymore, which is a good message, which I'm sure sends shivers down the spine of a lot of these folks.
Well, and then you look at the college admission scandal where these children of successful people were already privileged and already, you know, multiple cuts above kind of like middle class America from the high schools they went to, the tutors, the coaches, the prep exams, all that stuff. But that wasn't good enough.
Right.
The parents still decided like, oh, we're still going to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to cheat the system.
Well, you know, I remember we were talking about this because this happened last year and there was a kid, he was in a YouTube video and I read a story about him. He grew up in Queens, immigrant parents, very little money. He had no money for SAT courses that they could pay for or anything like that. He was going to the library and taking out old SAT study guides. He was on Saturdays and Sundays, he was taking trains across New York to go to free SAT tutoring classes, and he got into Harvard. And I said, I posed this to a couple of classes. Who are you going to hire? Him or somebody who paid whose parents paid $250,000 for them to get into a university? And it's like,
but that's the point. Like, point is, you might know that kid's story, but the other kid who had the unfair advantage, you might not know that.
Right. Yeah. And I'm sure there are others. But it's also, what message are you sending to your child? You're too dumb.
Oh, it's a terrible message for the child.
Yeah. Like, what are they, when they actually start to think about it, if they ever get this perspective, maybe having all that money means you never have to have this perspective. But if they actually ever had started to gain some insight and think, my parents had to bribe my way for me to get into a college because I'm too dumb and too lacking in talent. Like, this is what my parents think of me. And they're not even thinking of that in a cruel way. It's like they've examined the evidence, which is me, and thought...
And they're biased. That's their offspring. That's their children.
Right.
And they're still making the decision that they're too dumb.
Too dumb. Like, to get it. Well, you know what? If you don't have the test scores to get into Harvard, Yale, Princeton, then go to another school. You know, go to a school that's good for you. Like, there's nothing wrong with that at all. Nothing wrong with community college. There's nothing. Many, many successful people have come out of the city of New York. Public colleges come through the SUNY, the state schools, very successful people.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they work hard.
But even, you know, to instill in, you know, your children the notion that, you know, sometimes life isn't fair. Like, you can do everything perfectly, but sometimes the result is just not fair. It's a really hard lesson to learn. And, you know, obviously you don't want to teach it to your five-year-old, but it's how they absorb that and then bounce back from that. Because life is just a series of ups and downs, challenges, letdowns. You don't give up. You dust yourself off, you get back up, and you do it again.
Well, you know, like, you have two boys, one of whom just started high school, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Now, if somebody's son really wanted to get on the football team, and they worked out all the time, went to the gym, ran sprints, did it, you know, all year round, prepping to like ninth grade, they're going to try out for football, and they try out and they get cut. They don't make the team. And you're like, okay, well, I guess maybe I could go to the coach and give him $5,000 and say, put my kid on the team, please. And, you know, maybe the coach says, sure, no problem. Now, okay, that's one way to handle it. Or to your son, you say, listen, I really appreciate you worked really hard. You know, you worked your ass off. And that's the reward. Like, you understand that. Now, maybe football, maybe the team is just packed with talent. And there's a certain level where it's like, some kid is going to be faster, is going to be bigger, is going to be stronger, and just genetics have not. So okay, maybe baseball is your thing. Maybe track is your thing, swimming. Or try out again next year. Go for it again, you know?
Yeah, no, this is actually an experience, a personal experience. My youngest son did not make the seventh grade basketball team.
And you went ballistic.
I went nuclear. So we were refused to call the coach. Like, and we told him, he was distraught. We told him, all right, you have to go in and, you know, ask the coach, you know, why not? You know, what can I do to be part of the team? So the coach made him a manager, a captain, so he can practice with the team, but he can't play in the games. And then next year he'll try out again.
Now, is he willing to do that?
Yes.
See, there you go. Like, there you go. That's like, a lot of people would have said no. They would have said, nope, if I can't make the team, I'm not going to be manager, captain, whatever. It's, you know, but
the thing is too, is like, I knew all the kids that had tried out. And at one point I had coached some of them. And he legitimately should have made the team. But this is one of the instances where it's just one coach, one guy's opinion, and end of story. Nothing you do, but I'm not gonna call the coach and like present my case. It's a lose-lose scenario.
But do you know how many parents would have done that?
Oh.
And been I probably would have threatened the guy.
Oh, would have threatened him with, you know, bodily harm or getting them fired or
lawsuit,
whatever.
Yeah. No, I know. My parents would not have interfered with anything like that. I mean, if I had a teacher I thought was really unfair and I was getting bad grades, I'd be like, try harder, just work harder.
But the thing too is like, you know, he was really distraught, but it's like, okay, well, use this as motivation to work that much harder.
Right.
And then, you know, next year, you know, maybe you try out for the JV team as opposed to the eighth grade team if you work really, really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's life. I mean, there you go. Like sometimes
there it is in a nutshell.
Well, sometimes you have to deal with, and I don't like to subscribe to the notion that we're always just trying to prepare kids for the terrible ordeal of life. But sometimes many times you have to deal with people who, you know, I'm sure you've dealt with clients and things like that, who are absolutely wrong and being totally unfair and criticizing. And you're like, I did what you wanted me to do. Like you asked me to, and they don't like it, or it's one person's opinion. And you're just like, all right, well,
it's not just clients. It's, people I work with. It's, you know, competitors. I mean, you name it, you're going to deal with that on some level throughout your entire life. And it's how you react to it. It's how you hold yourself in those situations that, you know, builds character and shows character to people. You know, it's like how there's nothing worse than seeing someone with this, you know, whining or, you know, that I deserve this. No, if you really deserve, you know, show me, like, work harder. Like, life's going to throw you injustices. How are you going to deal with that?
Yeah, and I mean, one thing I would say is that...
I mean, I deal with it by suing everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I whine.
Just blanket lawsuits. Yeah,
about how the unfairness of life to me and how hard I work and no one appreciates me. And yeah, I definitely get into that. But yeah, some people do have this sense of entitlement. And I remember, I've said this to more than one person or a group of people, like, you're not an American through some talent of your own, right? You didn't do anything to be an American. You were just born here.
Lucky.
You're lucky. You're unbelievably lucky. But many people equate being an American with something they did. And so it grants them this exceptionalism, this entitlement. Like, this is our country. Like, what do you mean your country? What did you do?
Yeah, but so most people, their frame of reference is so limited. Like, go spend a day in a shanty town in South Africa or an Indian slum, and you'll realize how goddamn lucky you are.
Yeah. No. You know, it's amazing. He's not really, I don't know what he's doing now, but the Glenn Becks of the world, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, they've been able to convince people like my neighbors. I'm looking at their house right now, and they have a Trump flag hanging outside of it. They have a swimming pool. They have a Suburban. They have another very nice car. They have a big house. It's a big, nice house. They have been able to, and the Republicans have been able to convince those people that they are under threat. And they're being treated unfairly, and everybody's taking everything from them, and that's why they vote for Donald Trump.
It's a good point, but I just want to know how many times you've peed in their pool.
Every time I look at them, I think, you're on a terrorist training video. You are why people hate us. Because you have all of that, and you're still pissing and moaning and willing to vote for a man
who separates families. I used to be... in disbelief how people can support Trump, but now I understand why people support him.
And why is that?
It's because they want this almost like father figure, the strong man who will solve all the ills. Like Trump will, whatever reality is Trump is going to tell you kind of like what you want to hear. Like he drained the swamp. No, he didn't drain the swamp. He added to the swamp. You know, we're all doing fantastic. Oh, we're all doing great. You know, so it's this, like this, and I think they love that he's this strong man, this ego, this, or this persona. They love the persona of Trump.
That he can just shoot his mouth off and insult people and say, grab
women. And he's literally like Teflon. Yeah. He's almost untouchable.
I was watching this thing about, you know, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, their bassist, Flea. He, you know, came from a very poor background, and he donates a lot of money to the Los Angeles public school system for music, because he said, you know, music was really his kind of way out, his escape. Not just to be like a rock star, but to have something productive to do. And he was talking about Trump and their voters, and he said, he's like, you know, I grew up poor, and I just can't understand why these people vote against their best interests. Like, this man does not care about them
because they're lied to, and they don't have the knowledge to figure it out. Just on the Red Hot Chili Peppers, I met the lead singer. I was in a hotel. It was my sister graduating from Georgetown, so we're in this swanky Washington D.C. hotel because her friend's dad was a lobbyist and was like multimillionaire, so he rented out like the penthouse suite. Mm. Well, I guess the Red Hot Chili Peppers were in town playing at some venue. So we get in the elevator, and in walks the lead singer with this drop dead gorgeous model, like whatever his girlfriend was. And it was me, my sister, my brother, and my parents. And my parents had no clue. My brother and my sister knew who it was, so we introduced ourselves. My parents still had no clue. The doors open to the lobby, and literally, Matt, there must have been maybe like a dozen photographers and maybe 100 fans that just like almost kind of like fell into the elevator. And then his security was there like making a path. And then now we're part of this. We're part of this because... And my parents are like, who is that?
And you stepped out and started signing autographs.
Oh, I saw. I was signing. I put on sunglasses and I just started signing.
Did he seem like a personable enough guy?
No, he was a super nice guy. Oh, wow. Really, really nice guy. Hmm. Very personable. And, you know, he could have easily have been an idiot, you know, just kind of a dick in that moment. He was very nice. But he knew. It was funny because he knew my parents had no idea who he was.
That's probably kind of refreshing to him, you know, in a way that, you know, I could just imagine Al having an interaction with Anthony Kiedis.
Oh, no.
What's with all the tattoos?
All we did is
we just
said, you know, we just said hello and shook his hand. We didn't ask for like an autograph or like a picture or anything like that.
They are all very articulate guys. Like, they're all pretty intelligent. They're all pretty Anthony Kiedis did a little documentary with this artist I really like, Ed Ruscha, and like they just had a really nice conversation. Like, for not being educated particularly, like, they're all kind of street kids. They're very smart, like very, you know, very.
You don't really need, you know, an education to be deemed intelligent.
You just need to like pull your head out of your ass and read something occasionally, or you know, do something like that. But when you brought up being lied to, there is this idea that, you know, the way society is structured now with, you know, the wealth inequality and things like that, the old line of you just need to work harder to get ahead is just really, I mean, it does happen for some people. They're born in poverty and they do raise themselves up. No question about it. It does happen. But it's certainly not the norm, and it does take a lot of luck, too. So
absolutely.
You know, they're always, like, selling this notion that, and it goes back to what we're saying in the beginning. If you're not successful, it's your fault. You know, there's something wrong with you. You don't work hard enough. You're not smart enough, whatever it is. Well, I mean, if you grow up in poverty and you're dealing with a terrible public school system and, you know, there's no parent figures around and you're 14 years old and you have nobody providing you any guidance. I mean, you know,
What about like, you know, what about the single mother who's working, you know, three shifts and making $8 an hour? She's not working hard.
Right. Exactly. But again, as you say, she is seen as lesser. Like, she has gotten herself
absolutely
into that predicament. Or it's like, hey, you grew up in a crap family. That's your fault. Sorry, you kind of lost the lottery on that one. I grew up in a family where, you know, both my parents are very well educated and I was sent to the, you know, very good schools. And, you know, so, I mean, I've always been grateful that I taught in the South Bronx because it's sort of like, talk about getting a different perspective. It's like, wow, you know, like, this is a lot different from where I grew up. And they're, you know, kids, some of them really worked hard and they've done very well for themselves. And, you know, but this whole notion that all you have to do is work hard and that's it. It's like, no, there's a lot more to it than that.
But I do believe that our social structures and social programs should assist and help people to get back up on their feet and moving. Like, you don't want to create dependency. Right? Because that's not good for the organization and that's not good for the person. Because if they're, now let's take out of the fact that, you know, if you're, I was going to use the wrong term here. If you're, you know, if you have like a mental illness or you're handicapped or you have Down syndrome, I mean, obviously society or the government should provide for you, right? Because you're not going to be, but we also have to create what I think the U.S. should be. It should be a level playing field. So there should be a quality of opportunity, not a quality of outcome.
Yeah. I mean, I've always thought that there should be social safety nets that we could hold the bottom up.
Like, you shouldn't have to lose your house if you get cancer.
No, right. Yeah.
It sounds so ridiculous, but, you know, like right now, and this is not even equating to this, but this is how ridiculous the healthcare system is I'm fighting with my insurance company to get a device that like will cool my knee post-surgery. So it'll quicken the process. It's like a $300 like ice machine, and they will categorically not pay for it. And I have a prescription from my doctor for this, and my insurance company is like, oh, you can just use an ice pack. It's like, no, the doctor, like if the doctor prescribes me pills and I just decide that, Are you going to decide that I shouldn't take the pills because they cost too much money?
I think this has become a big sticking point, is that insurance companies are making medical decisions.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous because, like, the surgery itself is, like, tens of thousands of dollars. Like, it's ridiculous, right? So let's just, I mean, this wouldn't happen, but let's say, like, I don't ice the knee correctly and I have to go back into surgery, right? A $300 device would negate that or bring the probability down way down below, but they're okay with the possibility of paying another $30,000 as opposed to $300.
Well, and I'm sure they would fight you on the next surgery.
Fight me tooth and nail.
Yeah.
Tooth and nail.
Well, they're not the only institution. I remember a guy I worked with had worked, he had been in the Marine Corps, and he had worked on airplanes, was his specialty. And he said they would not, they'd be working on a billion-dollar piece of equipment, a stealth bomber, that was already obsolete. And you couldn't get them to spend another $4,000 for another couple of tool sets. So it slowed down work that they had to keep sharing the tools, and you could not get them to buy another
on a billion dollar. It's ridiculous.
I believe it's called pound wise and penny foolish, or penny wise and pound foolish.
Penny wise, pound foolish.
Yeah,
correct.
Like, you just won't. I mean, I get into these things sometimes too, where I'm like, you know, I don't want to spend a little bit of money on something, or I cheap out on something, like a lawnmower. You know, I paid 2 years ago, I paid about $180 for this thing called a Yardmaster. Piece of crap. Absolute piece of crap. The first one I had, the third time I went to use it, the engine blew out. And so I brought it back to Home Depot, so I got another one. That thing just, it's terrible. Absolutely terrible. So then I just bought another lawnmower for, I think, $350. You know, a Toro, really good brand. It works wonderfully. Well, I just wasted, you know, almost $200 on this other thing, trying to save $100, which is ridiculous.
Right.
You know, so, yes, we all fall into this trap. Well, folks, I don't want to say the American dream is dead. I wouldn't say that. People certainly do succeed on a smaller scale. Like, some people, you know, they open up a restaurant or a pizza place or something like that, and they do well. They, you know, my friend Justin opened up a used bookstore in Breckenridge, Colorado, and he's done quite well with it. I mean, there are definitely things, you know, he's not going to be a millionaire off of it, but he loves it, and he's good at it, and he makes a pretty decent living, and he gets to live in Breckenridge, Colorado. But there's not everybody who has that opportunity, and I guess people just get frustrated, and this is where you and I kind of differ on the Trump thing. Like, I think maybe, I don't know if this will happen by the next election, but the ironic thing, and what Flea was saying, is that so many of his constituents fall into this category of never being able to get ahead. And it's like, well, what has Donald Trump done for you to get you ahead?
No, zero. Well, nothing. And the other thing is his policies and his thoughts, his ideas are working against that. I mean, you look at immigration, right? So for the past, you know, 200 years, America has opened its arms to immigrants, and they've promoted that ideal, that American dream ideal, that you can make it here, right? If you have a good idea, you'll make it here. And there's been a bunch of companies started by immigrants that have come over. We still have the freest. It's the easiest, the least political, least corrupt to start a business, have an idea, start a business, and make a lot of money. But now that's changing because we don't want anybody anymore. We don't want your terrorists. We don't want your rapists. And that's going to have, the impact's not going to be immediate, but we could eventually feel that, and it could backfire on us.
Yeah. I mean, like, immigrants have always been the backbone of this country. Like, my great grandparents were immigrants, you know, it's like, but nobody,
same with mine.
No, forget that. No, but that was different. Like, right. Yeah. It's always different. It's always,
and when they came over, they were heavily discriminated against, the Irish and the Italians.
Yeah. Yeah. But nobody, no, it's always different. Like, yeah, we shouldn't have been discriminated against, but these people should be discriminated against, because it's always different.
It's a skin color, or their ethnicity, or religion, their religion, whatever
language, it is. Yeah, I know. But yeah, there was a guy, and I'll just end with this. There's a town called Saugus, where this guy had emigrated here in his like late teens, worked for years in the restaurant business, which Anthony Bourdain said would collapse without immigrant labor. Like, they just couldn't run restaurants.
Oh, absolutely. Agriculture. City. I mean, there's a whole bunch of industries.
So,
child care.
He opened a restaurant up there. Very successful. People love it. He got grabbed by ICE, and they're going to deport him. It's like, what purpose does this serve? Now his business is going to close. People aren't going to have their restaurant. People are going to be out of work. Like, that's great. That is, what a brilliant plan.
Well done. Well done, America. Well done.
All right, everybody. Sorry, not to be a downer here, of course. You can get out there, work hard, get your idea. But I guess it's just important to be realistic about it.
Yeah. All right, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. And as always, please share this on social media and rate us. Look for us on iTunes. We're averaging like 3 episodes a week now, which is pretty good for us.
Not bad at all. Good output. Not bad at all. Of course, you hear me yawning. I'm cast out.
Yes, this is past Maddie's bedtime.
I am just done. All right, everybody. Thanks a lot for listening.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of The Working Experience. We'd like to thank our sponsors, One Circle Media and the Still Believe app, the only app that delivers video proof of the Tooth Fairy and Santa by simply taking a picture. Download the app at stillbelieve.co today and amaze your kids. And if you work for a studio, network, startup, or corporation and are looking for a partner to create media that will build, engage, and entertain your audience, reach out to me at john@onecirclemedia.com. I would love to hear from you. And that's it. The end. The sweet end. Until our next audio encounter.